Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're the place that takes those really dense technical documents and, well, cracks them open for you, gives you that shortcut to understanding.
And today, we're diving into something pretty fundamental for law enforcement on the roads. It's the DWI Detection and Standardized Field Sobriety Testing Curriculum, the SFST manual.
Right, this is the playbook, essentially.
It really is. It pulls together, behavioral science, a bit of toxicology, legal procedures, all into one system. It's built on decades of research, validation studies by NHTSA, that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
So our goal here isn't just like listing off the steps an officer takes.
No, not at all. We want to get into the why, understand the science behind it, the whole philosophy of enforcement, and the legal framework that holds it all together when an officer suspects someone's driving impaired.
And you really have to start with why the system is even needed, the scale of the problem. It's just, well, it's huge. The statistics are pretty sobering.
There really are. If you look at, say, 2020 data, 11,654 deaths directly linked to alcohol-impaired driving crashes. That's 30%. Nearly a third of all traffic fatalities in the U.S. that year involved a driver impaired by alcohol.
30%. That translates to, what was it? One death every 45 minutes.
Every 45 minutes. Think about that. That's someone's life, preventable, gone. About 32 people every single day.
It really drives home the urgency. But then there's this other layer, the sheer number of people actually doing it versus who gets caught, the enforcement gap.
Oh, absolutely. The estimates are kind of mind-boggling. They figure around 300,000 episodes of intoxicated driving happen every single day across the country.
300,000.
But then you look at arrests, typically fewer than 3,000 per day.
That's a tiny fraction, like 1%.
Less than that, yeah. A huge disconnect. Yeah, that feeds right into this idea the manual talks about, the average driver fallacy.
Right, because you hear that stat, maybe one in 50 drivers on the road at any given time is DWI, about 2%. Sounds kind of low, maybe.
But that's the average across all times, all days. It hides the real danger zones. The manual, based on NHTSA research, points out that late-night weekend hours, that number jumps dramatically.
How much?
On a typical Friday or Saturday night, late, could be as high as 10% of drivers are DWI.
One in 10.
One in 10 cars passing, you might have an impaired driver behind the wheel. And holidays could be even worse.
And beyond the terrible human costs, there's the economic impact, which is also massive.
It really should get everyone's attention. You add up lost work, medical bills, property damage, emergency services, all of it. Alcohol-related fatalities cost us something like $44 billion just in 2019.
$44 billion.
So it's not just a safety issue, though it's definitely that. It's a huge economic burden, too. Makes the case for better standardized detection even stronger, from every angle.
Okay, so we see the problem. Immense. How does law enforcement even begin to tackle something happening 300,000 times a day? What's the strategy?
Well, the main goal, the core philosophy, is what they call general deterrence.
General deterrence.
Since you physically can't stop every single impaired driver, you try to influence everyone else, the entire driving public, make them afraid of getting caught.
So it's about creating that perception of risk, making people think, hey, if I drive after drinking, I will get pulled over.
Exactly. It's less about changing deep-seated attitudes about whether it's wrong, though that helps, and more about the immediate fear of consequences: arrest, fines, losing your license, jail time, the unknown.
And the manual actually puts a number on what it takes to make that fear real, doesn't it?
It does. To get significant general deterrence, the research suggests law enforcement needs to catch about one DWI violator for every 100 times it happens. That 1 to 100 ratio, that's the target.
But we just said it's more like one arrest for every, what, 500? Maybe even 2,000 violations.
Exactly. It's often way off that target. And that is why detection skill, the officer's ability to spot impairment, is the absolute bottleneck.
Because if people think the odds are one in 2,000, well, the fear factor just isn't there.
It evaporates.
Yeah.
And this is where the training distinguishes general deterrence aimed at everyone, based on fear of the unknown, from specific deterrence.
Specific deterrence. That's for the people who have been caught already.
Once someone's gone through the system, the arrest, court, maybe jail, the fines, the license suspension, and the consequences aren't unknown anymore. They're very real. Specific deterrence uses that known pain to hopefully stop that specific person from doing it again.
So reactive versus proactive.
Precisely. General deterrence needs to be visible, proactive, frequent. And we actually have proof that doing it right works.
You're talking about the Stockton example from the 70s.
Yeah, Stockton, California, between 76 and 79. It's like the classic case study in the training materials. They launched this really intensive, coordinated DWI enforcement effort.
Focused on the high-risk times.
Exactly. Weekend nights. They gave officers specialized training, really sharpened their detection skills, and they publicized the heck out of it, made sure people knew the police were out there looking.
And it worked. Like, actually made roads safer.
Big time. DWI arrests shot up 500%. But more importantly, weekend nighttime crashes dropped by 34%. And they estimated the actual number of impaired drivers on the road went down by a third.
Wow. So it proved that better detection skills plus visible enforcement, it actually deters people.
Absolutely. It showed it wasn't just about writing more tickets. It was about changing behavior and saving lives.
But the flip side is why this training was so crucial in the first place. That Fort Lauderdale study from 75, it really showed how bad things were before standardization.
Oh, that study is eye-opening.
Yeah.
Researchers basically set up situations where officers pulled over drivers who were legally drunk. Their BACs were between 0.10 and 0.20%, way over the limit.
And the officers?
The officers failed to spot the impairment and make a DWI arrest in 78% of those cases.
78%? They just let them go.
Yep. Maybe wrote a ticket for a minor traffic violation, like weaving or something, and then let them drive away drunk.
So for every impaired driver they actually caught, three or four others had been stopped, talked to, and were sent back out on the road still impaired.
That finding was a bombshell. It just screamed for a better, more systematic, more scientific approach. And that led directly to developing this standardized field sobriety testing curriculum we're breaking down.
Okay, so if officers were missing that much, clearly understanding the substance itself is key. Let's get into the science. What exactly is the alcohol we're talking about?
Right, good transition. When we talk about alcohol in the context of DWI, we're almost always talking about ethyl alcohol, ethanol, or ETH as you see it written sometimes. That's the alcohol in beer, wine, spirits, produced mostly by fermentation.
And it's important to know it's different from other alcohol.
Very important. You've got methyl alcohol, methanol or wood alcohol, and isopropyl alcohol, isopropanol, rubbing alcohol. Those are seriously toxic if ingested. Ethanol is toxic too, obviously, but it's the one people consume. And chemically, its key characteristic, it's a central nervous system depressant, a CNS depressant.
Meaning it slows down brain function, reaction time, coordination, all that.
Exactly. It dampens the signals in your brain and nervous system.
Now, to measure how much someone...
It gets absorbed really quickly. Unlike food, it doesn't need much digestion. Some gets absorbed right through the stomach lining, maybe 20%. The vast majority, maybe 80%, passes into the small intestine and gets absorbed into the bloodstream from there very rapidly.
And once it's in the blood?
It travels everywhere, but it doesn't spread out evenly. Alcohol loves water, so it distributes itself in proportion to the water content of different body tissues.
Meaning it concentrates in places with lots of water.
Right, like muscle tissue and, critically, the brain, which is mostly water. Tissues with low water content, like body fat, don't absorb much alcohol.
Ah, and that's where the difference between men and women comes in terms of BAC.
That's a huge factor. It's purely down to physiology and body composition, generally speaking. The typical male body is about 68% water. The typical female body is around 55% water.
Why the difference?
Generally, women tend to have a naturally higher percentage of body fat or adipose tissue, which holds very little water. Men tend to have a higher percentage of muscle mass, which holds more water.
So same weight, same amount of alcohol.
The woman has less total body water to dilute that alcohol in. So the concentration of alcohol in her blood, her BAC, will often be significantly higher than the man's, even if they weigh the same and drank the same amount.
That's a really important point. Okay, so the alcohol is absorbed, distributed, causing impairment. How does the body get rid of it? Can you just like sweat it out or pee it out?
Only a tiny bit.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 to 10% of the alcohol leaves the body unchanged through breath, urine, sweat. Just a small fraction.
So where does the rest go?
The overwhelming majority, over 90%, has to be metabolized, broken down chemically.
Yeah.
And that job falls almost entirely to the liver.
The liver does the heavy lifting.
Yep. There's an enzyme in the liver called alcohol dehydrogenase. Mm. That's the main worker bee that breaks down ethanol.
And how fast does it work? Can you speed it up with, you know, coffee or a cold shower?
That's the big myth.
Yeah.
No, you really can't. The liver works at a pretty constant pace. The average person eliminates alcohol at a rate that lowers their BAC by about 0.015 per hour.
0.015 per hour.
Roughly. It can vary a little bit person to person, but it's remarkably consistent on average. And nothing, not coffee, not exercise, not throwing up, not a cold shower, significantly speeds up that liver enzyme's work rate.
So if someone's BAC hits 0.15, which is nearly twice the typical legal limit,
they need about 10 hours. 10 hours for their liver to process all that alcohol and get back down to zero. Time is the only thing that truly sobers you up.
10 hours, wow. But then why do people often feel like they're sobering up faster, like they feel much better after an hour or two, even if their BAC is still high? Is that the Mellenby effect?
That is exactly the Mellenby effect.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly dangerous from a driving perspective.
Explain that. How does it work?
Okay, so the Mellenby effect basically says that your subjective feeling of intoxication is greater when your BAC is rising than it is when your BAC is falling, even at the same BAC level.
Wait, say that again?
Okay, imagine someone drinks quickly and their BAC climbs up to, say, 0.12. They might feel really drunk, dizzy, maybe nauseous.
Yeah.
Peak intoxication feeling. Now, let's say 2 hours pass. Their liver has been working, and their BAC has dropped back down to 0.10. Mm. Now, 0.1 is still legally impaired, still significantly impairing their driving ability. But because their BAC is now falling, they might feel much less drunk than they did when their BAC was rising through 0.10 on the way up to 0.12.
So they feel better, less impaired, even though objectively, they're still just as impaired, or maybe even more functionally impaired in some ways, at that 0.10 level.
Precisely. The brain develops a kind of rapid, short-term tolerance, acute tolerance, while the BAC is going up. So on the way down, the same BAC level doesn't feel as bad. The actual impairment to reaction time, judgment, coordination might still be severe, but the perception of impairment is reduced.
And that's dangerous because?
Because people trust their feelings. They think, oh, I feel much better now. It must be okay to drive. But their BAC is still high. Their skills are still compromised. Their own body is essentially lying to them about their level of impairment.
Yeah.
It makes them way more likely to make that terrible decision to drive.
That makes the officer's job even harder then. They can't rely on the driver's self-assessment at all. They need objective evidence.
Absolutely. Which brings us right into the structured detection process, the three phases. It's all about the officer systematically identifying and gathering evidence to build probable cause for a DWI arrest.
Okay, phase one, vehicle in motion. This is what the officer sees before they even pull the car over, right?
Yeah.
The driving itself.
Exactly. This is the observation phase. The officer is looking for driving behaviors that are known indicators of impairment. And this isn't just guesswork. NHTSA did extensive research identifying specific driving cues and calculating the probability that a driver exhibiting those cues is DWI.
So there's actual data behind which cues matter most.
Tons of data. They group the cues for cars into four main categories.
Let's break this down. What's the first category?
Most common group is problems maintaining proper lane position. Things like weaving within the lane, crossing lane lines, straddling a line, making unusually wide turns.
Swerving.
Yeah. Drifting. These cues have a pretty high probability, statistically somewhere between 50 and 75% chance the driver is impaired, if you see these things, which is a direct failure of motor control.
Okay, what's next?
Category two is speed and braking problems. Probability here is around 45 to 70%. This includes stuff like stopping way too far from the line at a light or stopping too short, jerky braking, speeding up and slowing down for no reason.
And driving too slow.
That's a big one, yeah. Driving 10 miles or more below the speed limit without a reason. Often, that's an impaired driver trying really hard to overcompensate, trying to be extra careful, but they just can't manage speed properly.
Makes sense. Third category.
Vigilance problems. This is about attention. Probability around 55 to 65%. Key cues are things like driving at night with no headlights on.
Ooh, yeah.
Slow response to traffic signals, red light turns green, and they just sit there. Or stopping at a traffic lane for no obvious reason. Sometimes they've literally fallen asleep.
Terrifying. Okay, and the last category.
Judgment problems. This has a wide probability range, 35 up to 90%. It covers things like making illegal turns, turning abruptly, driving the wrong way on a one-way street.
Things that show really poor decision-making.
Exactly. And the highest probability cues, like driving on something that's not the road, cutting across a median, driving on the shoulder for a long distance, those have up to a 90% chance of indicating DWI. If you see that kind of driving, something is seriously wrong.
The manual also mentions specific cues for motorcycles.
Yeah, because riding a motorcycle requires so much more constant balance and coordination. Impairment often shows up even more obviously. and sooner.
What are the big ones for bikers?
They list several excellent predictors, meaning 50% or higher probability. Things like having trouble getting off the bike, problems with balance when stopped, like at a red light, needing to put both feet down or wobbling, or drifting badly during a turn or curve. Simple actions become really difficult.
Okay, so the officer sees one or more of these strong cues, makes the decision to stop the vehicle. That moves us into phase two, personal contact.
Right. Now the officer is face-to-face with the driver. The decision here is, do I have enough evidence now to ask this person to step out of the vehicle for field sobriety tests?
And this phase is all about using the senses, right? Sight, hearing, smell.
Yep, gathering sensory evidence. It's also the first real chance to observe the driver's ability to handle simple interactions, follow instructions, divide their attention.
Let's tick through those sensory clues. What are they looking for visually?
Sight clues include bloodshot or watery eyes, maybe soiled or messy clothing, fumbling fingers trying to get out the license or registration, and of course, spotting alcohol containers open or even empty inside the car.
Smell, pretty obvious one there.
Yeah, smell is key. The odor of an alcoholic beverage coming from the car or the driver's breath, but also the smell of marijuana or sometimes strong cover-up odors like way too much air freshener, perfume, or mouthwash trying to hide the alcohol smell.
And what about hearing? What clues come from just talking to the driver?
Hearing clues are things like slurred speech, thick tongue, maybe mumbling. Also, inconsistent answers to simple questions. You ask where they're coming from, they give a totally unrelated answer. Or sometimes they just admit it, yeah, I had a couple of beers. Admissions are strong evidence.
This phase also mentions using some simple tests before the formal SFSTs, like divided attention tasks.
Right. These aren't the big validated SFSTs, but they're quick ways to assess impairment. They're designed to challenge the driver's ability to multitask mentally and physically, right there in the driver's seat.
What kind of things?
Simple stuff, like asking for two things at once. Can I see your license and your registration, please? An impaired person might really struggle to process both requests, fumbling or only providing one item.
Okay.
Or slightly more complex mental tasks, like the alphabet technique.
Yeah.
Can you recite the alphabet starting with the letter E and stopping at the letter P? It disrupts the automatic ABC sequence, or the countdown technique. Could you count backwards from 67 down to 52? Picking unusual start and end numbers, avoiding easy ones ending in 0 or 5.
These really force the brain to work, which is hard if it's impaired by alcohol.
Exactly. They quickly reveal cognitive difficulties. Then, the final bit of phase two evidence comes as the driver gets out of the car, the exit clues.
What kind of clues are those?
Things like leaning heavily on the car door for support, stumbling when they get out, having trouble closing the door, maybe leaving the car in gear. Just difficulty with the simple physical act of exiting the vehicle.
Okay, so pooling all that together, the driving, the face-to-face interaction, the exit, the officer makes a decision. And if they suspect impairment, we hit phase three, pre-arrest screening.
This is the critical decision phase. And it centers almost entirely on the standardized field sobriety tests, the SFSTs. Based on everything observed so far, plus the performance on these tests, the officer decides if there's enough probable cause to make the arrest for DWI.
Now, these SFSTs, the word standardized is key, isn't it? You can't just wing these.
Absolutely critical. Standardization is everything. The high accuracy rates we're about to talk about, predicting whether someone's BAC is 0.08 or higher, those rates only apply if the tests are done exactly according to the NHTSA and IACP procedures.
Meaning?
Meaning the instructions given, the way the officer demonstrates, the specific movements looked for, the scoring criteria, even the timing. It all has to be done by the book. Every single time.
If an officer deviates, changes instructions, misses a step,
the validity of the test is compromised. Those impressive accuracy numbers from the big validation studies, San Diego, Colorado, Florida, back in the 90s, they were achieved under strict, standardized conditions. It's science, not just random exercises.
Okay, let's get into the tests themselves. The first one, the most reliable according to the research, is horizontal gaze nystagmus. HGN. What is nystagmus?
Nystagmus is just an involuntary jerking or bouncing of the eyeballs. Everyone's eyes will jerk if they look way off to the extreme side. But certain substances, especially alcohol, and also things like CNS depressants, inhalants, and dissociative anesthetics, cause that jerking to be much more pronounced and to happen much sooner at less extreme angles.
And it's involuntary. The person can't control it.
That's the key. You can't stop your eyes from doing it if you're impaired in that way. Alcohol messes with the neurological signals between the inner ear's balance system, the vestibular system, and the eye muscles. The brain loses precise control, so the eyes jump or jerk as they try to follow a moving object or hold a fixed gaze.
So the officer is looking for specific signs of this jerking. There are three clues in each eye, right? Six total.
Correct. Six possible clues. The officer checks each eye for the same three things.
What's the first clue?
Clue one, lack of smooth pursuit. The officer moves a stimulus, usually their finger or a pen light, smoothly back and forth in front of the person's eyes, about 12, 15 inches away. A sober eye will follow it smoothly, like it's gliding. An impaired eye will often jerk or jump as it tries to track the stimulus. The manual says it looks like a windshield wiper moving across a dry windshield, stuttering, not smooth.
Okay, that's a good visual. What's clue number two?
A clue two, distinct and sustained nystagmus at maximum deviation. The officer moves the stimulus all the way to the side, so the eye is looking as far over as it can go without the head moving. Then they hold it there for at least 4 seconds. If the eye shows distinct, noticeable jerking back and forth while held at that maximum angle, that's a clue.
4 seconds minimum hold. Okay, and the third clue, you said this one relates more directly to the level of alcohol.
Yes, clue three. Onset of nystagmus prior to 45 degrees. This is crucial. The officer slowly moves the stimulus out from the center towards the side. They're watching carefully to see at what angle the jerking begins. If that jerking starts before the stimulus reaches a 45-degree angle from the center of the person's face, that's a clue.
How do they judge 45 degrees?
For most people, at 45 degrees, you can still see some white of the eye showing on the side closest to the nose. The key is, the higher the person's BAC, the sooner that jerking will start as the eye moves outward. An angle of onset less than 45 degrees indicates significant impairment.
So three clues per eye, six total. How many clues does it take to strongly indicate impairment?
The research, particularly the Big San Diego study, found that if an officer observes four or more clues out of the possible six, that accurately predicts that the person's BAC is at or above 0.08, about 88% of the time.
88% accuracy. That's really high for a field test.
It's the most accurate of the three SFSTs. That's why it's usually done first.
Officers also check for vertical gaze nystagmus, VGN. What's that?
VGN is jerking when the eyes look straight up and are held at maximum elevation for about 4 seconds. It's checked after HGN. Seeing VGN is a significant finding. It usually indicates a high dose of alcohol or the presence of certain categories of drugs, like dissociative anesthetics or sometimes inhalants. It's a big red flag for serious impairment.
Okay, moving on to the second SFST. The walk and turn, or WAT. This sounds like a classic sobriety test.
It is, but the standardized version is very specific. It's a divided attention test, meaning it requires the person to focus on more than one thing at once, listening to instructions while balancing, and then balancing while walking, turning, and counting.
It has two parts.
Yep. First is the instruction stage. The person has to stand in a specific heel-to-toe stance, arms at their sides, and just listen to all the instructions for the walking part without starting early or losing balance. That alone is tough if you're impaired.
And the second part?
The walking stage. They have to take 9 heel-to-toe steps down a real or imaginary line, touching heel-to-toe on every step, keeping their arms down, counting the steps out loud. Then they have to make a specific turn, a series of small steps, keeping 1 foot planted. And then take 9 heel-to-toe steps back up the line, again counting out loud.
Wow, that's a lot to remember and coordinate. What are the clues the officer looks for? There are 8 possible.
8 potential clues. Yeah. 2 happen during the instruction stage. 1, cannot keep balance while listening to instructions, like stepping out of the stance. And 2, starts too soon before told to begin.
And the other 6 are during the walking and turning.
Right. 3, stops while walking for more than a brief pause. This shows they can't maintain the divided attention. 4, misses heel to toe, leaves more than half an inch gap between steps. 5, steps off the line. 6, uses arms to balance, raising them more than 6 inches from their sides. 7, makes an improper turn, doesn't do the small steps as instructed, maybe just pivots or turns incorrectly. And 8, takes the wrong number of steps, more or fewer than 9.
So out of those 8 clues, how many indicate likely impairment?
The research found that if a person shows 2 or more of those 8 clues, it accurately predicts a BAC at or above 0.08 about 79% of the time.
79%. Still quite good. Okay, third test. The one-leg stand, OLS.
Another divided attention test, maybe even more demanding mentally.
How does it work?
The officer instructs the person to stand straight, feet together, arms down. Then raise one leg, either one about 6 inches off the ground, keeping the foot parallel to the ground. While holding that pose, they have to look at their raised foot and count out loud. 1001, 1002, 1003, and so on.
For how long?
For a full 30 seconds. The officer times it. That 30-second duration is critical.
Why 30 seconds specifically?
The original research showed that many impaired people could maybe manage to balance for, say, 20 or 25 seconds, but they often lost control before hitting the full 30. So the duration itself is part of the challenge.
What are the clues for this one? Four possibilities.
Four clues, yes. One, sways noticeably while balancing, like a pronounced wobble or rock. Two, uses arms to balance, raising them more than 6 inches. Three, hopping on the anchor foot to keep from falling. And four, puts the raised foot down one or more times before the 30 seconds are up.
And how many clues signal impairment here?
Again, the standard is two or more clues. If someone exhibits two or more of those four signs, the OLS accurately predicts a BAC at or above 0.08 about 83% of the time.
83%. So HGN at 88, OLS at 83, Watt at 79. Pretty strong indicators when used together correctly.
Exactly. They complement each other.
Now, often before the arrest, an officer might use a preliminary breath test, a PBT. What's its role? And it's not the main evidence, is it?
No, it's definitely not the evidential test. The PBT is considered a pre-arrest screening tool. Its main purpose is to help confirm that the impairment the officer has observed through the driving cues, the personal contact, and the SFSTs is likely due to alcohol. It helps establish probable cause.
So it shows alcohol is present, but it's not used as the final BAC number in court.
Generally, no. PBT results are often not admissible in court for proving the specific BAC level, partly because they have limitations.
What kind of limitations? Why the caution?
Well, PBT devices out in the field can be susceptible to a couple of things. The biggest one is residual mouth alcohol. If someone took a drink or even used alcohol-based mouthwash or burped, the alcohol vapor in their mouth could give a falsely high reading that doesn't reflect their actual blood alcohol level.
How do officers deal with that?
Protocol requires a deprivation period, typically 15 to 20 minutes, before giving the PBT, where the officer ensures the person doesn't smoke, eat, drink, or put anything in their mouth. That lets any mouth alcohol dissipate.
Okay, what else?
Other breath contaminants can sometimes interfere. Things like acetone, which could be present on the breath of diabetics or people on certain diets. Even heavy cigarette smoke right before the test, or exposure to certain paints or solvents, could potentially affect some older PBT models. And radio frequency interference, RFI, from the police radio, could also be an issue sometimes.
So it's a useful indicator, connects the observed impairment to alcohol, but the real evidential breath or blood test happens later, after the arrest, under more controlled conditions.
Exactly. That's the one used to prove the BAC for a per se charge in court.
Okay, that brings us nicely to the legal side. The officer's done the phases, done the SFSTs, maybe used a PBT, made the arrest. How does this play out legally? You mentioned two ways to prosecute.
Right. The legal environment shapes how all this evidence is used. The first way is under the state's DWI law, often called driving while under the influence or driving while impaired.
And for that charge, the prosecution has to prove actual impairment.
Yes. They need to convince the judge or jury that the person's ability to operate a vehicle safely was lessened due to alcohol or drugs. Here, the officer's testimony about the bad driving, the slurred speech, the stumbling, the poor performance on the SFSTs, that's all primary evidence. The chemical test result, the BAC number, is important supporting evidence, but it's not the whole case.
Okay, what's the second way? The per se law.
The per se law is simpler in concept. It makes it illegal in itself, that's what per se means, to drive with a BAC at or above a specific level, which is 0.08 in almost all U.S. states now for drivers 21 and over.
So for a per se charge, the BAC number is the main evidence.
Pretty much. If the prosecution can introduce a reliable chemical test showing a BAC of 0.08 or higher, that's generally considered presumptive evidence of guilt under the per se statute. Case closed, more or less, if the test is valid.
But the officer still needed probable cause for the arrest in the first place, right? Based on the impairment observed.
Absolutely. You can't just randomly test people. The officer needs that reasonable belief the person is impaired before they can arrest and invoke implied consent laws to get the evidential test.
What's implied consent?
That's the law in all states now. It basically says that by getting a driver's license and driving on public roads, you have implicitly consented to take a chemical test, breath, blood, or urine, if you're lawfully arrested for DWI. You can still refuse, but refusal typically comes with automatic penalties, like immediate license suspension, regardless of whether you're ultimately convicted of DWI.
Gotcha. So even with a strong BAC number from the evidential test, the officer's initial observations and testimony are still critical.
They are the bedrock. Imagine a case where the driver blows a 0.13 BAC well over the limit. But maybe the officer's report is sloppy, their testimony is confusing, they can't clearly describe the driving or the SFST performance. A good defense attorney can attack that, raise doubt about the initial stop or the arrest, maybe even get the BAC result thrown out or just confuse the jury. Conversely, maybe the driver's BAC comes back at 0.06, below the per se limit. But if the officer gives clear, detailed chronological testimony about really bad driving, obvious confusion, maybe falling down during the SFSTs, that driver could still potentially be convicted under the impairment prong of the DWI law, even with a low BAC. The officer's articulation of the evidence is paramount. They have to testify like the chemical test might not even exist.
And how do courts view the SFSTs themselves as evidence, specifically HGN?
Courts generally accept HGN results as scientific evidence of impairment, but only if the officer testifies they were properly trained according to NHTSA standards and followed the standardized procedures exactly.
But they can't use HGN to guess the BAC number.
No. Courts have consistently rejected attempts by officers to say, well, I saw 6 clues on HGN, so I estimated the BAC was 0.15. HGN shows the presence of neurological impairment consistent with alcohol or certain drugs. It doesn't provide a specific number.
Okay. Now, we focused heavily on alcohol. But the SFSTs, especially HGN and observing the eyes, are also gateways to detecting impairment from other drugs, right? The DRE Drug Recognition Expert Program builds on this.
Exactly. The SFSTs are often the first step. A DRE goes much further. But any officer using SFSTs needs a basic understanding of how different drug categories might present, particularly looking at the eyes. And this is crucial because polysubstance use mixing drugs or drugs and alcohol is really common. DREs find it in about 34% of their cases.
So let's quickly run through the 7 major drug categories recognized by the DRE program and how they typically affect those key eye indicators, HGN, VGN, and pupil size. Starting with the category alcohol belongs to, CNS depressants.
Right, central nervous system depressants. Besides alcohol, this includes things like barbiturates, sleeping pills, anti-anxiety drugs like Valium or Xanax. They slow the body down. Behavior is often drunk-like, sluggish, disoriented, slurred speech, eyes. HGN is usually present.
Mm-hmm.
VGN might be present in high doses. Pupils are generally normal.
Okay, opposite effect. CNS stimulants, cocaine, meth, amphetamines.
Yep. Central nervous system stimulants speed everything up. Hyperactivity, restlessness, agitation, fast talking, maybe teeth grinding, eyes. HGN will be absent. VGN will be absent. But pupils will generally be dilated, larger than normal.
Interesting. No HGN VGN is a clue itself. What about hallucinogens? LSD, psilocybin, peyote, MDMA ecstasy?
These alter perception, mood, thought. Behavior can range from withdrawn and dazed to paranoid, agitated, maybe seeing things. Body tremors are possible. Eyes, HGN absent, VGN absent. Pupils usually noticeably dilated.
Next, dissociative anesthetics. Things like PCP, ketamine, DXM, and cough syrup.
These distort perception of sight and sound, produce feelings of detachment. Behavior can be bizarre, confused, maybe combative, often with a blank stare, possibly very rigid muscles, eyes. HGN is generally present, VGN is generally present, pupil size is generally normal. That combination is a strong indicator for this category.
Narcotic analgesics, opioids like heroin, morphine, codeine, fentanyl, oxycodone.
These primarily relieve pain, but also cause euphoria, drowsiness. Look for lethargy, being on the nod, maybe track marks. Speech might be slow and raspy, eyes, HGN absent, VGN absent, but pupils will generally be constricted, pinpoint, even in dim light. That's a classic sign.
Inhalants, glue, paint, gasoline, aerosols.
Abused by breathing vapors. Cause effects similar to alcohol, but very rapid onset, often short duration. Look for disorientation, confusion, slurred speech, residue of the substance around the face, strong chemical odor, eyes. HGN is generally present, VGN may be present, pupil size generally normal.
And finally, cannabis, marijuana, hashish.
Effects include altered perception, relaxation, maybe increased appetite, sometimes paranoia. Look for bloodshot eyes, body tremors, maybe impaired short-term memory, difficulty dividing attention, eyes. HGN absent, VGN absent. Pupils are generally dilated, though this can be variable and affected by light conditions more than some other drugs. Also, lack of convergence, where eyes don't cross smoothly when focusing on a close object, is often seen with cannabis.
So by systematically checking HGN, VGN, and pupil size, along with the SFSTs and other observations, an officer can start to narrow down the possibilities, even when dealing with the complexity of potential drug impairment or mixed substances.
That's the idea. It provides a structured way to look for physiological signs beyond just the smell of alcohol.
Okay, this has been incredibly detailed. Let's try to wrap up the key takeaways from this deep dive into the DWI detection manual.
I think the first thing is just the sheer scale of the problem. You know, 1 in 50 drivers impaired on average, but maybe 1 in 10 late on a weekend night. And the tragic cost, one death every 45 minutes.
Yeah, and the core strategy to fight that is general deterrence, trying to raise that perceived risk of arrest from maybe 1 in 1,000 towards that goal of 1 in 100.
Which hinges entirely on effective detection skills, moving through those three distinct phases. Phase 1, vehicle in motion, looking for those validated driving cues.
Things like weaving, driving too slow, vigilance problems, probabilities often over 50%.
Right. Then phase 2, personal contact, using sight, hearing, smell, plus those pre-exit divided attention tasks. Asking for license and registration, the alphabet, or counting tests.
And finally, phase 3, pre-arrest screening, relying heavily on the SFSTs.
The key there is standardization. The high accuracy of those tests, HGN at 88%, one leg stand at 83%, walk and turn at 79% for predicting 0.08 BAC, or above that accuracy, depends entirely on doing them exactly as prescribed.
Plus, understanding the legal framework DWI versus per se, implied consent, and the crucial role of clear, detailed officer testimony, regardless of the chemical test result.
And remembering that these methods also provide clues for impairment by drugs other than alcohol, especially by observing the eyes.
So let's leave our listeners with a final thought, something to chew on, maybe.
Yeah, let's circle back to that science, specifically the Mellenby effect. We talked about how someone's feeling of impairment goes down faster than their actual impairment level as their BAC falls.
Right. They feel better, but they're still dangerous.
Exactly. So the provocative question is this. If a person's own internal sense of sobriety is fundamentally unreliable, if their biology is essentially lying to them, how much can we really rely on campaigns that just say, know your limit or drink responsibly? If feeling isn't a good guide, what does truly effective public education about impaired driving need to look like to account for that disconnect between feeling and reality?
Mm-hmm.
How do we convince people they aren't safe, even when they start to feel like they are?
Mm. A really tricky question about perception versus physiological fact. Definitely something to think about. Thank you for breaking all this down.
My pleasure. It's complex stuff, but critical to understand.
And thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll catch you next time.